All right, we're trying to deal with the question of what has led to this problem of truth decay. And I found about seven acids, then I want to dilate a little bit on the eighth one, television. And then get to the whole next outline. Right. All right, what has caused this misunderstanding of the concept of truth, the erosion of the concept of truth, especially with respect to deeper worldview issues, religion, spirituality? There are several things. These are reasons that are given. Now, of course, I don't think any of them are sufficient. Some people claim that the Enlightenment was an attempt, growing out of the Renaissance, to capture reality through reason, through experimentation. But now we know that that grand Enlightenment project of shaking off religion and superstition and using our unfettered minds to capture the nature of the true, the good, and the beautiful was a sad mistake, and we simply have to move on beyond that, that this Enlightenment goal was a grand failure. Now, this is a very one-sided, in fact, misinterpreted view of the Enlightenment, because if you're talking about David Hume, he had no such designs on reality. He was a radical skeptic. He didn't even know if other people existed, let alone knowing what the good, the true, and the beautiful was. So this really caricatures the Enlightenment, and moreover, you can distinguish the epistemology of a movement from its truth claims. It could be that the epistemology of the Enlightenment was radically wrong in certain ways, maybe not recognizing the limitations on human knowing or the need for human knowers to receive revelation from God. But that doesn't mean that objective truth does not exist or is unknowable. That simply does not follow from that. Or people might say a unified worldview is impossible today because of our cosmopolitan, media-saturated environment. This is the claim of Kenneth Gergen in his book, The Saturated Self, a book of complete defeat intellectually. He says, there's really no need to try to separate the true from the false, the beautiful from the ugly, because we are in a media enclosed environment. And we have all sorts of voices going in our heads from advertisements, from other people, from traditions and history and so on. And so his goal is what he calls the saturated self. You're saturated with all sorts of voices, all sorts of ideas. You can't win. You can't sort them out. You can't divide them into the true and the false or the good and the bad. So simply absorb them and use them for your own purposes in a pragmatic way. So there's a stock of ideas and stock of quote-unquote lifestyles out there, and simply select from them what works for you. And if it ceases to work, then select some other ideas, some other ideals, some other goals, some other styles. That is, reinvent yourself. There's no idea of a fixed moral character or a moral authority that brings the self to bear, brings the self, in fact, up short before reality. Related to this, thirdly, a unified worldview is impossible today because of the great diversity of religious viewpoints that are available. So the notion is, how can anyone sort it all out? How could you be so arrogant to say that your view is true? Somehow they are all true. Somehow they all are true in the sense of being meaningful for various people groups or various language users, or giving a sense of value and significance to people. That's what truth then means, as opposed to correspondence to reality or something you would defend as true through rational argument. It's not a defense that something is true by saying, this is the way my community speaks, or this is the tradition that I've learned, or these are the symbols that we take to be meaningful about the transcendent. That's not a defense that your view is objectively true. That's simply a sociological, historical, psychological description of states of affairs. Now, 2 and 3 basically our intellectual capitulation. It is not impossible to have a unified and coherent worldview in these sorts of environments. It's just more difficult. It's the difference between being impossible and being difficult. In a pluralistic setting, if you want to keep your intellectual integrity, you have to sort out what you believe and why, as opposed to what other people believe and why. And that may not be easy. It's not a matter of simply averting to your tradition or averting to what your church teaches. If you want to be intellectually engaged, with people that believe far differently than you do, it takes some work. And instead of simply saturating yourself with various ideas and trying them out in different ways from time to time, you have to engage in reflection, analysis, hard intellectual work. And frankly, while our culture challenges you to succeed financially and to succeed aesthetically in what you look like, and to gain wealth and to gain influence and to have it your way, we typically do so at the expense of intellectual work. Except that which is instrumental. Okay, you have to work really hard in law school so you can be a successful lawyer. But what about the philosophy of law? What about the relationship of law to moral principle, to a transcendent source, and so on? Well, you don't have to bother with any of that if you don't want to be a very successful lawyer. Four, people argue that postmodernity does not allow for a fixed sense of personal identity. There's so many options, so many possibilities, that the notion of the righteous way, the true path, the narrow way, a determinate set of vices, a determinate set of virtues, is out the window. It's all negotiable, it's all fungible, it's up for grabs. So given all these possibilities, you simply select attributes for the self. Or you select a particular kind of look, or a particular kind of style, or a particular brand. So your identity is more related to the brand of products you use and what you look like and your personal style than it is with a unified and coherent and applicable worldview, or with a set character. So give up on the idea of a unified self. There is no unified self. There are only masks. Now I want to say, who's trying on the masks? Fifth, and this is a pivotal point we'll come back to next week, language is contingent on human beings and cannot communicate objective truth. Yes?
My question kind of concerns both 4 and 5, but mostly 4. Now, I realize that McLaren didn't write the Bible, he just kind of wrote a book, but he did bring up an important point that postmodernism is here and it's in our faces, and if we want to kind of invade that front, we kind of have to speak their language so that they understand what we're talking about. How do we introduce such a foreign concept to people that are postmodernists, that kind of concept of a fixed sense of personal identity and objective truth?
Well, again, there's no short answer to that. It's the rest of the class. We have to realize that people are situated in conditions that make Christian truth hard to understand, hard to digest, hard to put into practice. We recognize that. But we never want to compromise or capitulate or accommodate a non-Christian worldview or a non-Christian sensibility. That's my concern with McLaren and his ilk, is that postmodernism now is in the driver's seat. In fact, we have to reconfigure Christianity according to postmodern dicta. And I absolutely will not do that. You're not going to reinvent Christianity. Right? Jude 3, the faith given once for all, entrusted once and for all to the saints. That was on your quiz. Once and for all. So we keep mining it for significance. As one wag said, there may yet be more truth to break forth from God's Word. But it breaks forth from God's Word, and we apply it to the world, and we apply it to culture creatively and faithfully. But there always has to be a sense of untimeliness and prophetic abrasion to the Christian witness. We do not want to simply blend in. We are not called to be chameleons. By untimeliness, I mean the willingness and the knowledge to say what needs to be said, even if people don't like it, and even if people rebel against it, because it's true, and because it needs to be said, and because God wants us to say it. Now, the abrasion comes that this chafes against people's sensibilities. But I say, give them something meaty enough, solid enough, weighty enough to get angry about. Now, I'm not saying you're trying to make people angry from the get-go, but let's say you're preaching an Easter message and you know the people are coming who are not believers, many of them have imbibed postmodernist sensibilities. You want to defend the historic objective resurrection of Jesus Christ and show the significance of this for this life and eternity. You don't simply want to say, the symbol of the resurrection gives our community deep meaning, and spend the whole sermon on that. You've missed the point. You've missed your moment if you've done that. See? And that's what I worry about, is that we don't have this sense of untimeliness, this sense of being prophetically abrasive when it needs to be said, because why, no one else is saying it. Now, I don't want somebody to just try the Christian niche or try the Christian style and see if you think it's cool, because that's too worldly. I don't see Jesus or the apostles or any of the prophets operating like that. See? And that's what I worry about with the Brian McLarens of the world. All right, language is contingent on human beings and cannot communicate objective truth. Now, of course, that could not be communicated if it were true. We'll come back to this. But many people will very confidently say that, oh, language does not hook us up to objective reality. Language is simply an activity of organisms that accomplishes things. It's creative. It creates cultures, but it comes out of our biology. And there's no way to really mirror nature through language, to use the language of Richard Rorty. All those statements presuppose what they deny. They're self-refuting. Any statement that is self-refuting must be false. It is necessarily false. People oftentimes use language to tell you that language cannot communicate truth and expect you to believe it. It happens repeatedly. And watch for it when people say it. We'll come back to that. But this is a very strong strain. We've already referred to it here at some level being taught at Baylor and is taught in public schools. It's sort of the deconstruction of language. We thought language was high and exalted and was a way whereby human beings could connect with reality through concepts and propositions. Oh, it's none of that. It's just a behavior of organisms to get things done. And so you create reality linguistically. There was a professor once taught at a Christian university not far from here, and we used to get into a variety of debates on these issues. And I said, David, did the law of gravity exist before there were any human beings to name it? He said, no. Now, it's hard to know what to say next. It's hard to know what to say next when someone says that. But this was taught at CCU. Okay? These things are taught at Baylor. This is just in the cultural atmosphere. And people are not thinking clearly about it, philosophically or theologically. Yes? Well, because contradiction is a necessary ingredient of consistency. So you can't communicate anything if you don't care about consistency, because the opposite of what you say could also be true, so you can't affirm anything. So people might say, well, I don't care about consistency, I don't care about absolute truth. But then when they get pulled over for speeding, when they're going 40 miles an hour and the cops say they're going 50, they drop all that. See? Or when someone accuses them of lying, and they say, no, I didn't lie, I told the truth. They're presupposing the correspondence view of truth, and they're presupposing the law of non-contradiction. See, it's very difficult existentially, we'll get to this when we talk about apologetic method, existentially to be a consistent irrationalist. Because you still try to communicate truth to people through reason, even in spite of yourself. There really is no consistent communication or thought or action without consistent rational affirmations. Okay? There's no difference between poison and vitamins if consistency means nothing, if the law of non-contradiction means nothing. There's no difference between invading Iraq or leaving it alone. Same thing, doesn't matter. So people at a very basic level understand that when they contradict themselves, something is deeply wrong. Now, people may selectively do it. They may, well, I can contradict myself here, but not here. And then I say, why? What gives you special privilege to contradict yourself in this realm, but not in this realm? Then they'd have to give an argument. And to give an argument, they have to use logic, which they're not supposed to use, to defend this area of illogic. The toughest thing you will have to deal with many people who are non-believers today, is not their finely tuned arguments against Christianity. It's their hatred of argument. Did you hear me? One of the toughest things you'll deal with is not their finely tuned arguments against Christianity, but their hatred of argument. So then you have to move apologetics back a few more squares and give an apologetic for reason. That human beings should attempt to be as reasonable as possible because it's something that defines who we are. And it's a necessary condition for any kind of intelligible discourse, thought, or action. And you use examples with people, everyday examples, to show them that when their mind is working properly, it's working consistently. And that inconsistency is an intellectual vice. Okay. All right, related to 5, 6 is written texts have no objective determinative meaning or truth. So written texts are negotiable, revisable, deconstructible. They indicate various things about the authors and about the culture of the authors and about the history of the authors, but they do not communicate anything knowable about reality. Now, of course, that claim, again, is self-refuting because you're claiming to do the very thing you say cannot be done. But this, you see, has undermined the value of the word in our culture. This is the philosophical undermining of the value of the word. There is a sociological and cultural undermining, largely through television and video, which we'll talk about in a moment. But if you believe that no text means what its author meant, then the text no longer has literally any authority over you. It now becomes your game. You can manipulate it any way you want because it has no fixed meaning. The older notion was that texts carry with them a meaning, an objective meaning, which should be deciphered or discerned. And it is the burden of the interpreter to discern it aright. Once you have discerned it aright, you might think it's a wrong. All right? But at least you got to the meaning of the text. But deconstructionism doesn't believe in singular meaning or objective truth. I'm being very broad, and there are differences between Derrida and others and so on. But the basic core is what I'm going for. So people will say things like, well, you can interpret the Bible any way you want. It's like a wax nose. You can make it into any pattern you want to. Meaning what? It has no intelligible, determinative meaning. And that is supposedly true for any text. So texts are now divorced from reality. So you play with them. You don't really learn from them. It's a very different attitude of the human being before a text than the classical attitude. 7, some will say that truth is not a matter of objectivity. It is not defended rationally. But it's a function of power relationships. So various institutions and individuals define what is taken to be true. Truth is not correspondence to reality. It's not objective. It's not a matter of the facts. It's a matter of how the society paints the picture or how the elite groups or institutions construct a picture of the world. Now, there's a half-truth to this, isn't there? And this is the whole area of the sociology of knowledge, which should be better called the sociology of belief because it's really not concerned with knowledge. Knowledge is justified true belief. It's a special kind of belief that's rational. But the sociology of knowledge, as practiced by, let's say, Peter Berger and others, wants to understand how people come to believe what they believe, why some things are intellectually taboo, and why some things are intellectually virtuous. Now, that is at least partially defined by elites. For instance, the scientific elites in our culture, particularly the biologists, are rather committed to something called Darwinism, even when the facts fly in the face of Darwinism. And they control the grant money And they control the tenure process, and they control the hiring process, and they control the graduate programs. So, of course, Darwinism is going to be institutionalized in a setting like that. Does that mean Darwinism is either true or rational? No. Could be the elites are radically wrong and eventually may begin to see that. We'll talk about that later in the class. But the idea of truth being constructed by power relationships is absurd. I mean, if you say truth is constructed by power relationships, is that constructed by some power relationship? If so, then it's deconstructed itself. It's eliminated itself. You're just the voice of some power entity. You're not the voice of objective reality. There is a tacit assertion of reality in human language. Most of the time. A tacit assertion that what I'm saying is not just making an acoustic blast or writing down symbols on a piece of paper or a keyboard or a screen, but that I am somehow connecting with something extra-linguistic, extra-textual, extra-internet. Something real. It's a tacit assumption of most human statements. Even when people are denying it's possible. Yes?
To follow that with logical language, we have to change all the books from nonfiction to fiction.
Sure. The category of fiction and nonfiction ends up blending. Because people say no one is really objective, no one is really disinterested. Well, of course. But we've known that ever since the fall. We're not perfect logic choppers. We're not perfect observers or reporters. Fallenness enters into human descriptions of states of affairs. Duh. I mean, we've known that for a long time. It means you have to be crafty. You have to be careful when you interpret texts. The author may be deceiving you. The author may be manipulating you. But you have to try to discern the intended meaning and then see if that meaning matches reality or not. And if someone's attempting to write history, it's not the same as fiction. Now, fiction may have been written accidentally. Okay? But those categories require the concepts of objective truth, the correspondence view, and logic applying to reality. There's no question about it. All right, now that's very quick and dirty over some of those basic themes, but questions or comments before I rant a little bit about the role of television in all this. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, people are often told to be, not explicitly, but they're told to be irrational in their purchases. So the brand, the logo, is far more important than the objective qualities of the product. All right, like Evian mineral water. The stuff is more expensive than just about any liquid you can imagine, and it's just water. It's just bottled water. If you spell it backward, it means naive. Now, the whole thing about Evian bottled water, I mean, think about it. The whole thing is the image. The whole thing is the brand. It's twice as expensive as all the other water, and it doesn't taste twice as good. So it's an image. It's a brand that evokes a feeling. It evokes a story in place of fact. And we are a consumer-driven culture, and we are told to impulsively purchase items according to feelings. Little stories, little characters, little mottos. I could go on and on and on about this. So if you are habituating your patterns of life to a consumer ethos, you have dumbed yourself down significantly. Because then when it comes to deeper worldview questions, you will use the same sensibility, which is basically gut reaction, no hesitation, no consideration, very little reflection, just, well, how does that feel? You know, or does that resonate with me? So some people say, well, we don't have to deal with apologetics, objective truth, rationality, all that hard work. It's a bunch of eggheads anyway, you know, rationalists and all that. It's just whether or not you resonate with the Bible or whether a non-Christian will resonate with your community or how you tell a biblical story. Well, it could be your resonator's broken. All right? It could be you've got to go beyond the resonator to the rational, to the evaluative. It could be we even have to retrain people on how to think before we can communicate Christianity effectively to them. Because they're thinking in consumerist, resonator terms. Not in terms of take up your cross, deny yourself, and follow me. I'm the Lord of the universe. Well, what's in it for me? That's not the question. Is he who he said he was? Is that threefold command binding on your human condition or not? And are you even going to investigate it or remain naive? Good point. All right, let me try to contain myself and limit myself in the next section. I will probably fail, but I will try. One of the main agents of truth decay in American culture and Western culture is television. Now, I am not going to go on and on about how bad things are on television. That is the content, the profanity, the immodesty, the sexual ethics, the blasphemy. I'm not even going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about the form of television and how the form of television affects us cognitively. This is often left in the background because television is everywhere in our culture. It has reached the pandemic stage. Or to use a term from oncology, it has metastasized. It's just about everywhere in our culture. I couldn't find the clipping, but some of these new air carriers are now giving you a personal video screen for every seat in the airplane to compete with the other carriers. One thing I used to like about flying is that I could get some reading done. Or maybe talk to the person next to me. Now apparently these screens are always there and they're always on. They're always on. My wife took a flight recently and on the way back she brought a piece of paper and tape so she could tape over it so she could read or sleep or something. So it's in restaurants, it's in airplanes, it's in classrooms. The average house has about 3 or 4 television sets. It's in some automobiles. You can get waterproof televisions to put in your shower. Do I have to go on and on? Now, why is this? And if this is the case, visibly and physically, then what is it doing to our minds and our ways of thinking? This is what I'm concerned about. And I'm really jamming on a riff by Marshall McLuhan years ago in Understanding Media, 1963. The medium is the message. What did McLuhan mean, the medium is the message? The medium, to cash it out a little more analytically, shapes, affects, and contours the message. The medium matters. If you listen to this online, this lecture, it's not the same as being here in person. All kinds of body language, connection that I have with you, your responses to me, expressions that I make, and so on, you will not get in a simply audio form. If you take the lecture I'm giving and simply write it out and read it, it is not exactly the same lecture. The content is there, but you still miss something. But it's different. You can reread it. Now, you can ask me to repeat something, but it's a different sensibility in a lecture because a lecture has a flow. It has a pulse to it. Whereas reading, it's just there. It doesn't move. You move it by your understanding of the material. Now, television has an intrinsic and inexorable flow to it. The medium matters. And the medium affects those who interact with the medium. Now, what's happened with television in the last 50 or 60 years, it has moved from the periphery, from the margins of society, to the core of society. It's moved from the background into the foreground. And has become a tremendous blind spot. We don't analyze it. We don't think about it. We don't consider the effect it has on our thinking processes, on our attentiveness, on our sensorium. All right? Your sensorium is how you take in the world, how you hear, how you see, how you think, how you comport yourself physically. That's your sensorium, the way you take in reality. It affects your sensorium because of its very nature, its very structure. Let me give you 4 points here. My thesis is that television, given its very form, tends to undermine a view of truth that is objective, absolute, and universal. And it tends to undermine a view of truth that is antithetical. That is, if A is true, non-A is false. And once you lose that, the law of non-contradiction, anything goes intellectually. First point is that in the television sensibility, the institution, the moving image trumps or humiliates the written or spoken word. Now, biblically, God has a bias towards words. and towards language and towards texts. You know, the Bible never describes the person of Jesus physically, except that he was a male. There is no need to describe what he looked like. Isn't that different from our culture? In fact, we are not to depict God. It's in the Ten Commandments. Go back there and read them once in a while. Make no image of the deity whatsoever. I agree with the Westminster Catechism and Confession. I think that means all three members of the Trinity. Most people disagree with me. But anyway, don't make an image of God. Why? God is not picturable. There is no image that captures an infinite, omniscient, all-knowing, perfectly good being. Every image fails because God is invisible. God will manifest himself in certain ways, in certain situations. But God is intrinsically invisible, and to understand God, you must master certain, oh no, abstract concepts. Omniscience, immutability, omnipresence. Now, God invades history. He demonstrates his attributes to a degree in history. So these are not mere propositions divorced from stories and narratives and real-life situations, by no means. But the being of God cannot be pictured. Now, this tells us that images are limited in their ability to communicate truth. In fact, images may affect you, may move you, may cause you to purchase certain items, may cause you to salivate, may cause you to be nauseous, may cause you to be excited, but they may not move you towards truth in the slightest bit. They are very powerful in terms of affecting human sentiment. They are not as powerful in terms of communicating truth. And our culture does not know the difference between the two very well. We are moved by images. We think in terms of images. We think seeing is believing when we have so many technologies to deceive through images. So the image has its limits in terms of communicating truth. Television is very powerful in its ability to deceive through image manipulation. I've done it. I've given interviews, and what I've said was distorted by taking one sliver of what I said and make it look like it was the only thing I said. I won't tell you that whole story, but I decided never to do a pre-recorded television interview since. Not sure I've been asked since, but I decided not to. At least by a non-Christian outfit. I was interviewed by a Radio Bible Church program, and they did a good job with what I said. But realize that they interview you for 40 minutes, they could take 20 seconds and put it out of in the wrong context. That routinely happens. So when someone says, they declined to be interviewed, you tend to think, oh, they're guilty, they're terrible people. No, they're smart. You're probably smart not to be interviewed by television. Malcolm Muggeridge, the great Christian writer and media savant, once said, the camera always lies. It does. It always lies. It's always selective. It always is put into a particular context, and you don't know why the context was selected. The worst way to find out about what's going on in the world is to watch television news. Yeah. Yes. Anything can be taken out of context, but images have a greater power and a greater immediacy in doing so. And our culture is infatuated and inundated by images, not by texts. You're right. It can be done, but it's harder. Especially if you have been habituated to the sensibility of interpreting a text as opposed to the sensibility of taking in images. You learn how to read. You simply watch TV. You can set a two-month-old in front of the television set. God help you if you do. And God help the kid. But that kid will become engrossed with the television because of the power of the images.
I think, though, there's an intrinsic defense with text, though, because often the text is written down in a place where it's accessible. You can go back and refer it and bring up the context. Whereas there's a recorded of an event in time and space that is often, you may not have access to the full recording. And even still, as you said, you know, what is recorded is not the same as what actually happened.
Right. They're very different in their nature and their structure and their ability to communicate truth. People say that media are neutral. It's just the content. It's wrong. Media are not neutral. They shape the message. They all shape the message. And to be savvy, you have to realize the strengths and limitations. And I think, why are you talking about this with apologetics? If people are saturated by images, and images are limited in their ability to communicate truth, people are limited in their ability to know truth because of a television-saturated culture. So we have to take that seriously. We are working against sensoria that are habituated to an image-based view of reality that is largely wrong, that is intellectually impatient, which does not brook fine distinctions, and often doesn't even care about contradictions. All that matters is a good soundbite. So let's say a particular candidate, who shall remain nameless, says A at one point and says non-A 3 weeks later with great conviction. If he says it with great conviction 3 weeks later and seems very authoritative about it, then that resonates with people because he has an image. See? Or if a candidate who should not be named picks a vice presidential candidate for his good looks and big smile and being very well endowed as being a trial lawyer, and not because of any political or moral competence, then there's an image. There's an image of a young, dynamic, powerful, upbeat, smiling vice president.
Nicer hair.
Nicer hair. Yeah, that matters. That's right. That's very important.
Whereas with an image, specifically television, you have somebody behind the scenes that is packaging it to be out of context.
Mm-hmm.
You can take the whole program or whatever and in context and it still be grossly misrepresenting reality.
Yeah, now editing takes place in every form of communication. But the fact is that images are easier to edit in a dishonest way. I mean, I had a student in a class a few years ago, I was working for a Christian video ministry. And he eventually quit because they were dishonest. They would be filming a conference, and they wanted to move people. They wanted people to resonate with the conference they were filming. So they would take a splice from another conference where someone was so moved that they were weeping, and they would splice it into the account of the conference where apparently no one was weeping. Now, what is that called? It's called bearing false witness against your neighbor. It's called lying. It's wrong. It is so easy to do that. And a lot of people's understanding of Christianity comes through movies and through the images they've seen on television. A lot of Christians' understanding of Christianity comes through that. See? Yeah.
So are you saying that...
Where is he going to go with this?
...that there's a problem with the editing?
No, it's the whole package. Right. Very limited.
So why is it better for me to be here in class watching you give your lecture than read it on paper?
I mean video images. I don't just mean sight.
Okay.
So for one thing, this is live. And it's serendipitous. A lot of what I do is unstructured. It's very planned, but it's unstructured, like this comment. Television, everything's pre-planned. Everything's pre-planned down to the second to produce a particular effect. You're not playing with a wire. Everything's planned. Oh, yeah. You know, I forgot to bring that bull they gave out. You know, the bull that President Wilford gave out? I have a new meaning for the bull. I'll bring it next time. When you squeeze the bull, it means there's some crap around. I'll bring that out. That would have squeezed the bull on that one. Yes?
Is being attempted to see is any worse than most newspapers? Around who I obviously don't read.
Yeah.
But for those of us to do and those of us who read through it, for information, that's got to be just as bad as a lot of it.
Well, it's not just as bad because it's text, it's print. And you see, print requires a certain discipline of the mind to decipher it. Even if it's a newspaper, even if it's written at an eighth grade level, even if it's not well done, you can still read it, reread it, compare it with other texts, think about what you know about the subject. It lends itself to more analytical reflection than images. That's the point. Now, can newspapers be biased, unfair, spotty in their reporting? Of course. Have you ever heard of the New York Times? But I'm talking about textuality as a way of approaching reality. And I'm arguing flat out it is superior to the manipulation of images on a screen. It gets you deeper. It requires more concentration. more analysis, more intellectual engagement. And this is one of the reasons. I haven't even gotten my three other chops yet. This is one of the reasons why people do not have a biblical worldview, is because of their habituation to the sensibilities of television. This is why many preachers are afraid to preach for more than 25 minutes, because it's longer than a sitcom. This is why some preachers put in commercials, and they think they have to be multimedia, because everyone is habituated and, yes, addicted and, yes, obsessed with television. But, in fact, you don't have to do that. You can preach longer. You don't have to use bells and whistles. Guess what? The Holy Spirit is still alive. Human beings are still made in the image and likeness of God. They can still think critically and rationally. They can still be engaged by argument, evidence, and even big words. It happens. I've done it. Other people have done it. See, this is back to McLaren. You don't want to just go with the flow. If people have a television mentality where the image trumps the word, I say, refuse it! Do not accept it! Do not go with the truncation of Christianity. Reject it utterly. And figure out creative and compassionate and high decibel ways to come against it. Don't simply try to put on a better Super Bowl halftime commercial. I mean, that happened a few years ago. People were very upset about the Victoria's Secret ads during the Super Bowl because parents are watching, or fathers, are watching this ridiculous game called football, which is just a matter of high-paid violence, and they're seeing the Victoria's Secret ads, and they're horrified, you know, because the kids are seeing the Victoria's Secret ads. And so the response by some benighted, benumbed Christians is, let's raise, you know, $18 million and run Christian ads during the halftime of the Super Bowl. I can think of 100 better ways to spend money. We're going to opt out of that world and get into a world where we can communicate truth a little more consistently, a little deeper, a little more reflection, a little more face-to-face, more textual, deeper, give something rich enough, big enough, meaty enough for people to understand, not just more factoids or more visual sound bites, so to speak. See. Now, this plays into apologetics at the level of where you engage and how you engage and trying to even set up environments where people might listen to you. I mean, one of the things we fight here are the sensibilities of intellectual impatience and laziness, and the image orientation, and the inattentiveness to text, and to logic, and to developed arguments. Okay? So part of what you need to do is incarnate a well-thought-out worldview that is not afraid of argument, and then you need to try to creatively find spaces, physical and sonic spaces, where there are no televisions, where there is no distraction, and human beings can engage each other rationally. This does not happen very much in American culture. That is good. That is fitting for an apologetic encounter, a discussion between human beings when there are no distractions. Is it possible? Is it possible in the church? Is there any silence in the church? Oftentimes there isn't. It's so noisy and so busy. But if you just take 10 minutes of silence, 10 or 10 seconds, 15 seconds of silence before a sermon or during a sermon, and just look at people. I've done it. It's great fun. And I'll say, I'm going to now do something that never happens on television. I go on to my next point. All right, we've got to go on. I'm only on point one. You're already all upset, which is good. It's what I planned. Second, is that television, the institution, the form, emphasizes discontinuity and fragmentation. This is what Neil Postman calls a peekaboo world. You play peekaboo with a little child, they get so excited because they think you're popping in and out of existence. Now, this is the way television works because there's so much discontinuity. Now, public television is a little bit better, but commercial television is the worst. You have maybe 10 minutes and then a commercial that has nothing to do with what was just on. You maybe have a minute and a half or 2 minutes for a news story, then another news story, then an ad for pantyhose, then a story about famine in the Sudan, and then we're on to a Cheers rerun or something. I mean, I have no idea when these programs come on because I don't watch television, but discontinuity as a way of life. Now, in order to think carefully and critically and logically in a linear fashion, you need continuity. You need the development of ideas. You need an environment that is friendly for prolonged reflection on thought. Television does not provide that for you. In fact, images come so quickly and are so discontinuous that it can be very intellectually disorienting. And I didn't bring my drumsticks with me, but I think I can do 30-second notes. All right? Images will come that fast on television, or at least 16th notes. You can't process that intellectually. You can't know what's going on. Discontinuity, lack of coherence, the and now this mentality. Why this? Does this relate to that? No, and now this, because it's the structure of the advertising. Now, this discontinuity as a way of life leads to intellectual impatience, recklessness, and distraction. In fact, recently in pediatrics, there was a warning. It said this: early television exposure is associated with attentional problems at age 7. Efforts to limit television viewing in early childhood may be warranted. That's an understatement. I mean, I had a student a few years ago in another class I do where I have a required media fast, and most people choose television. They turned off the television and they said, our 6-month-old is so much more interested in us now that he's not watching television anymore. Give me strength, God. Give me strength. You are sitting your 6-month-old in front of a television? Of course they'll be more interested in you if you turn that thing off. This scrambles the mind, especially in very young children who do not have the capacity to distinguish or delineate anything. But it scrambles your mind as well. Now, biblically, we should try to develop a coherent, rational worldview. Now, this can involve art, poetry, painting, all the rest of it. I'm not saying everything has to be related to texts, but the television mentality caters towards discontinuity and purposeful discontinuity to evoke some kind of an emotional response that has nothing to do with reason, nothing to do with reality. You have to ask, if you are taking in 2 or 3 or 4 hours a day of this, what the after effects are. Do you think there's no effect? Why is it they pay $5 million for 30 seconds in a Super Bowl ad? Because it has no effect on anybody? I don't know what the exact cost is, but it's got to be something like that. So truth decay. You see, you cannot apprehend truth unless your sensorium is hospitable to truth. See, there's truth, and there's the reception of truth in human beings. Now, how, literally, in God's name, do we get human beings to receive truth in this kind of an environment? You have to be alert. You have to be aware. You have to be creative. You have to be, I would argue, countercultural. You don't just put it all on television. Another problem is hypervelocities. That's related to discontinuity, the video equivalent of caffeine. You have things like jump cuts, rapid scene changes, special effects. And so things are moving so quickly, and there's so much discontinuity, you can't really think about things. Things are not developed. And this is true. I haven't really been to movies much for about a decade either, but I remember that when I went, my wife and I would be progressively frustrated because so many movies would have very little dialogue. Most of it was special effects. Very little acting for a lot of movies because the special effects took over the cinema. Right? I mean, you have some people that are supposed actors that are nothing but action figures, like Arnold, right? You don't really have to act with all the special effects. And they're so quick. They're so overwhelming. They just engulf you. But they're not really educating you. They're not really convincing you of something. And if that is your sensibility, and someone says, here is my worldview. Here's the view of Jesus and how he relates to the human condition, and it takes some time for me to explain this to you. And I don't have it on a video game. And there's not a film you can see. You need to think about it and read some things. That may be difficult for some people to do because they're habituated towards the image over the word, the discontinuity, and the hypervelocities. Yes? I've already explained that.
Yeah.
I agree with the Reformers. No images of any members of the deity. And I've got more to say too, but I'll limit it. I frankly don't understand why he wouldn't want to see it. The Bible does not depict in any detail whatsoever the crucifixion. There's no need to. People knew what it was like. And God in His infinite wisdom knew that people many centuries hitherto would not need to know what it was like either, given the text. I think it's gruesome. I think it's tasteless. And theologically, it's not needed. Moreover, I think it's probably theologically deceptive. I think you should have your knowledge of the atonement of Christ from the Bible, not from an image made by a very hyper-conservative Roman Catholic director who made his name through extreme violence in films. So I know, you know, I'm in the half of 1% here. My wife and I wrote a letter to Christianity Today about this. It was published, I guess, about 6 or 8 months ago, if you want to check that out. I didn't think it was great news for the kingdom by any means. I think it was basically capitulating to the image mentality. Now, can good come out of it? Sure. God brings good out of all kinds of things in a fallen world, but that's no argument that it's intrinsically good or that it was a good strategy. God does a lot of His work in spite of us, not because of us. All right, third point, hypervelocity. Fourth point, and this is so important, the entertainment orientation. Television must entertain. And television is everywhere, and it entertains through the image over the word, through hypervelocities, through discontinuity as a way of life. Now, amuse literally means don't think. Muse means think. You ever heard of invoking the muse? You know, the muse, I'm inspired to write. This happens to my wife and myself sometimes very late at night. You know, the muse, we just have to write into the wee hours of the night. Amuse means don't think. So Postman entitled his superb critique of television, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And everyone should read that book. Postman was more savvy about television than 95% of the Christians. And he understood the Bible better about images than 95% of Christians. Amusing ourselves to death. This means that every area of life has to be amusing. So why is it the television news has its own theme song? Why is the Gulf War has its own theme song and its own set and its own images? I mean, everything has to be amusing. Why is it that the most important thing about the anchor people is their hairdos and not their intelligence or their honesty? Postman calls anchormen and anchorwomen talking hairdos. Talking heads, talking hairdos. So the entertainment mentality trumps everything. Or as Jean Baudrillard, the cranky French social critic, put it, his book America, in America the laugh track is always running. You were always a giggle away. Now, this is very serious because entertainment and amusement are not appropriate for some things. They're not. Everything isn't funny. Some things are deeply serious and require lamentation and suffering. I mean, even AOL tries to copy television as much as it can because it used to just have one image that would be on there, the main news story, for 6 or 8 hours. Now it shifts a different image every 10 seconds. So one image might be of children in caskets in Russia having been killed by these demonic terrorists. Then the next image is how to have a better lawn. It's like it all has to be amusing. We don't be serious for too long. We don't reflect on anything for too long. We have to lighten the mood. Don't be too grave. Don't be too serious about anything. So, what I find in American Christianity, and this affects apologetics, because apologetics is serious business. It requires hard work. It's difficult. You're playing without a net in many ways. You may be challenged. You may be stumped. It may be uncomfortable. But the idea is that everything has to be amusing. There's a lack of sobriety, rectitude. Or, get this, orienting our subjective response to the objective nature of what we experience. Some things require silence and reflection. Some things require hard thought and pondering things. Now, it's not just television. It's talk radio. It's, in many ways, the internet. It is moving so quickly and in such an entertaining, titillating way that it's difficult to ever stop and just think about the gravity of about 1,100 parents, children, and teachers held hostage for 52 hours in Russia by Chechen terrorists, not allowed to drink anything, not allowed to eat anything, not allowed to go to the restroom. Then they blow everything up and shoot people as they're fleeing. 350, 400, maybe 500 people will have died in that event. These are children, most of them. Children. First day of school. Do you think about that, meeting your friends again? Thinking about your new teachers there with your parents, all happy for school, and your school is taken over by terrorists? I mean, I challenge you to just think about that for 10 minutes at some point in this week. What kind of a world we live in? What kind of a world we live in when something like that happens? What is terrorism in this world? And will Russia finally wake up? They better get on our team with this issue. But even if you don't agree with my political conclusions, just think about the enormity of the evil. But oftentimes we can't stand it. We can't stand evil. It's uncomfortable, right? So we move on. We change channels. We divert ourselves. We distract ourselves. But biblically, we should not be a lover of pleasure, but a lover of God. I summarized a class I taught last term with two words, Christian ethics and modern culture. It just came to me in the heat of the moment. I said, I could summarize this whole class in two words. Get serious. There's so much of evangelicalism that is so silly, so ridiculous, so mindless, so trivial. In the church, I've seen it for so many years. It's a lack of sobriety, a lack of gravity, a lack of attending earnestly to the Scripture, a lack of challenge, a lack of preaching repentance, preaching hard doctrines. Remember a woman at Riverside Baptist Church a few months ago said, when you preach, you really get into the Bible and you preach those hard things, it hurts, but it's good. And I said, it hurts me too. I mean, I'm preaching the cross and love God more than your family, take up your cross and follow me. It's got to hurt me first before I can come through me to you. So the truth hurts. Oftentimes it hurts. We're fallen beings. We don't gravitate towards the truth without kicking and screaming. Oftentimes, right? So how does all this relate to apologetics? These sensibilities are at war with people receiving the truth with sobriety. They are at war with it. Now, will a few glimmers of truth and goodness make their way into television and into movies and so on? Yes, certainly. But I'm talking about overriding sensibilities. The way people's sensoria are oriented towards reality. I meant to say disoriented towards reality. See, we're not simply working at the level of ideas and arguments. We are. That's non-negotiable. Worldview. And we'll get into more worldview next time. I didn't get as far as I wanted as usual. But we are dealing with inhibiting factors that keep people from orienting themselves with intellectual rectitude before reality. These are taken for granted. They are part of the structure of everyday life. The constant noise, the constant clatter, the constant gibberish, the flippancy, the glibness. Glibness. Now, there's a vice of American culture. Glibness. See it on television, talk radio, the movies. Everybody has a one-liner. Everybody has a quip. Everybody has a saying on the spot instantly about anything. Instant punditry. Sometimes the best thing to say is nothing. That's what Jesus said before his accusers, right? He was silent. For much of that, he was just silent. There's a section in the book of Revelation where it says there was silence in heaven for a half an hour, right? Let the whole earth be silent before him in the Old Testament. Can't remember the reference. There's a time to simply be silent and reflective and not chatter and not give a glib, quick, snappy response. But does our culture value that? What do we call it? Dead air. You're wasting time. You're wasting money. Questions, comments about these sensibilities, how they relate to apologetics, how they contribute to truth decay? Someone who hasn't asked a question yet. Is there anybody? Tim? Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, that's the whole area of aesthetics and culture, which we take up in another class. I'm not saying that all images are bad. We shouldn't have paintings. We shouldn't have sculpture. I'm not saying that. I'm saying they are limited, and we are an image-dominated, image-stultified society. That's my main worry. The rest of it in terms of art and the relationship of faith and art would take us into other dimensions. And that can have an apologetic force. There's no doubt about it. There was something, yes?
One comment and one question. Can you clarify that Russia better get on our own team?
Yeah, I think Russia should get on our side with respect to the war on terror. They are not helping in Iraq. Neither is France, neither is Germany. Now, that's a bracket. That's a political bracket. It's not intrinsic to this class. All right, I don't need to argue all that. I'm right, but I don't need to argue all that. I'm also right about John Kerry. But that's what you call political brackets. See, I am an unending opinion machine. And sometimes the opinions get kind of bracketed and they don't directly relate to everything else. Okay. Insurgents? I don't know anything about that.
Anyway,
I don't know anything about that. Yeah.
In Russia now, probably the most influential, at least evangelical, but maybe even Christian influencer right now is the man who basically is on television. People see him and they hear his health and wealth, prosperity, gospel every day.
Benny Hinn? One of the health and wealth people?
Yeah. But anyway, you know, he's on television every day. Mm-hmm. And he's actually having, besides if you're that type of doctoral person, you'd be excited about it. But from my perspective, at least somebody's preaching the gospel, at least they're hearing a little bit. Why isn't be a MacArthur, be a Swindoll, be a yourself? Why aren't you on television?
Nobody wants me on television. But I would certainly rather have good preaching on television. See, good preaching is bad television because it's boring. It's a talking head. It makes bad television. So it doesn't really fit the medium. So at least in the more television-saturated cultures, it just won't work. It won't be on a regular basis with any kind of an audience because it's not snazzy enough. It's not high-tech enough. Yeah, basically. Now, there are religious preachers on television. But again, I would rather have you in church. I would rather have you reading books than sitting and watching them preach on television. The preaching may be good, but it's not the same as being there. And that's why I'm against multi-site churches. You know the multi-site church idea? You have one sermon, and you beam it in various locations, and they watch the sermon. I'm totally against that. That's not incarnational. That's not relational. I mean, again, I've got all kinds of Riverside stories, Ralph, because I had such a good time there. But I gave a sermon on suffering, and I told a little bit about my own suffering and my wife's suffering. And I was standing up there, and a lot of people were coming forward for prayer, and it seemed like the Spirit was moving. This big old guy walks up, and I thought, well, he's going to walk down the front and kneel down. And he keeps walking and walking. He walks up on stage. He walks up to me, and all of a sudden he gives me this huge bear hug and just prays for me with tears running down his eyes. I thought, whoa, this is different. This was not in my notes. You know, you cannot plan things like that. It's relational. It's face-to-face. It's person-to-person. Even though it's just me and 500-600 people out there, that can still happen live. It can't happen when I'm on a video screen and I'm not there. So much of the communication and defense and the incarnation of the Christian ministry is face-to-face, life-to-life, unplanned, playing without a net, relational, person-to-person, communication, in all its dimensions. And once you reduce it to video, you have extracted a vital personal dimension. And you have introduced all sorts of other dimensions that may come back to haunt you. Yes? Sure. Sure. Yeah. Other comments? Yes? You can speak. You just did.
I'm also a secretary at a preschool, and we've had a whole bunch of people move in from out of state. And every one of them has said, where can we go to church? We'd like to go to a church where people share their testimonies, where people, you know, stand up and share, you know, with each other. And they're looking for that kind of, I mean, I was shocked. Everybody that came from out of state asked for that kind of church setting.
Well, it's very biblical, and it meets basic human needs. And that's really the best way to communicate with people. Now, there are a lot of means of doing it, obviously. Writing and things I've done have been put on video, and I admit it. I mean, I've been on television a few times. But it's not my preferred medium by any means. It really isn't. Other questions or comments? Somebody haven't called on yet, maybe? Yes. All right. Hey, that's what that guy looks like in the house. Good for you. Yeah, give yourself a particular period of time. You know, give yourself a week, and then evaluate what's happened to you during that week. One of the things it does, it frees up time to read. It frees up time to communicate. It frees up time to pray. I never forget a 14-year-old girl I talked to in Russia in 1993. Television had not yet dominated Russia. I don't know if it has now. But she said, sometimes my friends and I get together and watch television, but I really don't like it because when I go to pray, what I've seen on television distracts me from my prayers. So I don't want to watch television. Pretty wise, isn't it? Now, this is not just my rant. It is a rant. But it has to do, remember, with truth and how truth is received by human beings. What is conducive for the reception of truth and what tends to inhibit the reception of truth. We have to be concerned about that at, let me summarize, three levels. One level is, what are the spiritual and emotional barriers? Pride that doesn't like the cross. That's going to be there in any non-believer at some level, right? Another one is, people have legitimate intellectual objections to the faith that need to be listened to and clearly and cogently addressed. The third is, something that they have been habituated to in their sensorium that keeps them from either understanding or grasping the truth. It may not be a rational argument at all. It may simply be intellectual impatience. They don't want to listen to anything that takes more than 10 minutes. Or they don't want to deal with anything that will require some reading and some thinking. Or it could be they can't find time to do anything related to investigating Christianity because their life is completely saturated in media. See? So you've got these levels of concern to work with the unbeliever. The offense of the cross is always going to be there. The intellectual objections will be there with the people who have thought more about it. And the situation of the environment affects us all, really, in one way or the other. Even if you've tried to opt out completely, the way I have, when I don't watch any television at all, television still affects me. The way I find out about it is I read the newspaper about things that are on television and various things because I want to know something about what's going on, but I will not waste any time whatsoever watching television, except in emergencies to get the fast-breaking news And then I shut it off fairly quickly, because after the images have been trotted forth and you get the basic facts, there's very little analysis, very little context, and very little worth watching. And then I switch to newspapers, the internet, journals, and so on. You know, you really don't need to watch the Twin Towers fall 59 times. And in fact, nobody, this is an ethical issue, but I think it relates to our sensibilities of decency and propriety. There are very many things in our culture that are seen by millions that should not be seen by anyone. People are entranced by sinful curiosity. It's the same kind of curiosity that causes you to turn your neck when you pass an accident scene. There's no reason to see somebody on the ground in anguish, bleeding, about to get put on a stretcher if you have no reason to help them or no ability to help them. There's no reason to see that. In fact, I think it's impolite and improper. I turn my head now. I don't look at accident scenes because I don't want to embarrass people or make them feel worse than they already feel. And even if they don't know I'm looking at them, I just don't think I have the right to look at them. But you see, in a television infiltrated, infatuated, inundated culture, there's no sense of sinful curiosity. If it's out there, it's seeable, and in fact, you have a right to see it. And this absolutely boggles the mind if you just step back a little bit. Think about some of the people that decided to jump out of the Twin Towers. What a condition to be in. We either burn to death or jump to our death. And it's televised. Do you think those people would want to be televised jumping to their death? Do you think their relatives would want them to be televised jumping to their death? I don't think so. But there's no sense of restraint with the camera. There's no sense of, turn it off, we don't need to see this. Same with Columbine. Some of the scenes they showed of traumatized teenagers running out of a building, barely with their life, should never have been shown. They were immoral. They were inappropriate. In fact, a friend of mine emailed me from Britain and wanted to know if I knew anyone at Columbine or what was going on. And she said, we in Britain cannot believe the images we're seeing on C-SPAN. Our press would never be allowed to shove a microphone in the face of a teenage girl who just barely escaped the library with her life. They would not be allowed to do that. But the press in America can do anything and televise anything and distribute it to tens of millions, if not billions, of people. There's a radical sense of being out of kilter with reality because of the image infatuation. There are so many things that should not be seen that are seen. And they do no good. They do harm. They are radically impolite, inappropriate, and indecent. But it's fascinating, you see. In a perverse sense, it is amusing. I've never seen anyone jump 80 stories out of a building to their death before. I want to see it again. It's sick. And as soon as you realize it's sick, and it's driven by a mentality that tends to inhibit the reception of truth, the wiser you will be as an apologist.